Black Arts Movement was once described by Time Magazine as the single most controversial moment in the history of African American literature, and possibly in American literature as a whole. It was started in Harlem by writer and activist Amiri Baraka. The movement was triggered by the assassination of Malcolm X, and among the well-known writers who were involved with the movement were Nikki Giovanni, Sonia Sanchez, Maya Angelou, Hoyt Fuller, and Rosa Guy. The movement is also seen as the most important times in African-American literature. It inspired Black people to establish their own publishing houses, magazines, journals, and art institutions. Before the movement, the literary scene lacked diversity, to say the least, and the ability to express those ideas from the point of view of people of color. The Black Arts Movement changed that. It influenced the whole world of literature with the portrayal of different ethnic voices. Theater groups, poetry performances, music, and dance were centered on this movement, and therefore African Americans were becoming recognized in the areas of literature and art. African Americans were also able to educate others through different types of expressions and media about cultural differences. African American performances were used for political advertisement, organization, and community issues. The Cutting Edge presents a forum, The New Urban Aesthetics, The Black Arts Movement Revised, which was sponsored by the Harlem Book Fair at the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture.
My name is Mark Anthony Neal, professor of African and African American Studies at Duke University, and I'm the moderator for the next panel. The panel is The New Urban Aesthetics, The Black Arts Movement, in which we're going to have a conversation to talk about the connections between the Black Arts Movement and what we see now as new forms of urban aesthetics. I'm joined to my right to my colleague, who is doing double duty today, Professor Imani Perry from Princeton University. To her right, we have Melissa Castillo Garceau, who is the author of Pure Bronx, a book that she wrote with the historian Mark Nason. To her right, we have Mr. June Archer, who wrote the book, Yes, Everything Can Be a Good Thing. Next to him, we have Mr. Tramp Daly, The Adventures of the Untouchables, illustrator. And at the far end, we have Mr. Anthony White, who published the book, A Love to Die, what some folks might describe as urban fiction or street fiction. And we'll talk about the complications of that as we go on this afternoon. So one of the things that's interesting about this panel, there are any number of people, even in this room, as I sit here and look at Ms. Sonia Sanchez, who could describe what the Black Arts Movement was about, who were there in the room. What makes this panel unique is that none of us were in the room. And so it becomes an interesting vantage point to talk about what the legacy of the Black Arts Movement is for people who may not necessarily be engaged in the Black Arts Movement the way that we understand it historically, but have taken examples from the Black Arts Movement in their own work, both in terms of content, but also in terms of context, and also in terms of form. So one of the things I want to start with is to ask all of the panelists about what your sense is of the impact and the legacy of the Black Arts Movement on the work that you do as writers, illustrators, creative artists in general.
Well, good afternoon. My name is Anthony White. And, you know, back in the days, I met someone who was doing a show. Maybe some of you have seen the show or heard of it. It's called Zora Returns to Harlem. And the main character, Zora Neale Hurston, in that show was a good friend of Langston Hughes. And in doing her research, she told me one thing. She said, Anthony, you're writing hip-hop literature, which is great. But she said, did you know that Langston Hughes did jazz poetry? And that was news to me. So I researched it, and then I realized that jazz renaissance was big at the time that Langston Hughes was doing his thing here. And hip-hop music is big now that I'm doing my thing here. So there's some kind of correlation between his work and my work, historically speaking, that he used the music of the time, the rhythm, to forebear his words, to be the backdrop of his rhythm, of his lines, of his poetry. So in saying that, my dialogues are hip-hop, and meaning the iconic expression of rap is what I use for my character. So you'll hear, you know, I'm saying, you know, I'm doing. And, you know, it's colloquial, but it is communicative. And it's young, it's fresh, and it's like for the kids. And a lot of kids get into it, whereas their parents won't. So there's a correlation between jazz poetry and hip-hop literature, the rhythm.
I want to say on that for a second, Anthony, because when you think about some of the black arts poets, whether we're talking about the late Amiri Baraka, Donnell Lee / Hakeem Mahboudi, Professor Sonia Sanchez, they were all conscious of writing poetry that would resonate for young folks. I mean, Hakeem Mahboudi's talking about writing poetry that literally you could hear on the dance floor. So some of the rhythms and the cadences of how the poems were written were calculated to be able to sonically connect with young people. And so that becomes an interesting kind of way. It almost reminds me of the way that the previous panel talked about these kind of black truths that we don't even know exist. And so we have these young hip-hop artists, right, that are tapping into finding ways sonically to connect with young folks who are tapping into much larger traditions. Your book, Queer Bronx, right, of course, is about the multicultural contemporary Bronx, right? And let's just own up to the fact that the Bronx being the home of hip-hop, the boogie down, you know, as we referred to when I was growing up in the Bronx. What does the black arts movement look like in terms of a legacy in the Bronx, you know, 40 years, 50 years after that moment that we all celebrate?
Yeah, I think for me, and in terms of writing the book, it's really an attention to vernacular. It's really an attention to hearing the streets, to being inspired by walking along streets, to listening to how conversations are formed, and to just really try and hear, you know, the everyday life. And that's really what we try to infuse. Dr. Nason, who is my co-author, he also started the Bronx African American Oral History Project. So that was also really infused in terms of the way that we thought about the book, was really thinking about oral history. And for me, that's, you know, the work of Sonia Sanchez, the work of, even before that, you know, someone like Gwendolyn Brooks. It's really opening up your ears and listening to the community.
And I would suggest to everybody to take a chance to take a look at the work that Nason has been doing with this historical document, some of it of which is available on video now, and it is actually a great interview with the late historian Vincent Harding, who grew up in the Bronx, went to Morris High School in the Bronx, and has Bronx roots. For someone like yourself, Tramp, and you're working outside of a literary context. Again, this is a conversation that came up in an earlier panel.
Yes.
What does the black arts aesthetic look like in terms of where you're working in terms of illustration and comics and what have you?
Well, I think Anthony touched on a real good point. I mean, I come from the world of graffiti, but like I've started in The Source. When The Source first had a comic show, I did A View from the Underground, and it was creating characters, and I'm kind of known as like the hip-hop Disney. I have like 10,000 characters. So what he said about the rhythm from the blues era to the hip-hop era, when I write, like, me and him are also working on another lit book called The Badlands, The Love to Die For, where I wrote the script for it. So whether I'm writing or drawing, it's always to the rhythm of that. And I usually, you know, of course I'm going to aggregate a lot towards hip-hop from, like, I have Grandmaster Caz doing a voice over for one of the characters. I got DMC. And you can see the lineage of what they tell in the story. So, like, I would look at them as the poets that, or the writers that I'm really researching from probably like late 70s when I was born to like 80s, 90s and so on. So I look at their stories and like one story that they write grab me, control me, and it makes me want to go and create the art. So like cats will come up to me and be like, yo, that's this slide. And you know when people come up to you and say that means they're really kind of saying like, yeah, you know, I might want to buy that. And to me, when you're looking at that, we try to make the illustration speak for itself, so it has a literary form. So I had one page in The Source that I, or one or two pages with the comic strip, and Rakim came up to me one time and he was like, you're the reason I get The Source. Because I had 5%ers in there, and he was like, nobody's talking about us. And I was like, all right, word, you know, but I did it because he wrote his rhyme. So I think the correlation for me was really to, you know, you love a song, it grasps you and it motivates you. I think any art that motivates you to do the art that you want to do, that's transcendent. It kind of takes you to that next level. So I think like Harlem's the Mecca, you know, you got the Bronx, and that fusion of that is really like this, like for us, it's the center point of the whole world. And that fusion comes from that, and we're like an extension of that. You know, how graffiti came about, and then the characters from graffiti and so on.
What does the legacy of the Black Arts Movement look like for you, June?
Well, for me, because if we want to touch on the hip-hop aspect, for me, writing my book was a matter of breaking down barriers because it's so male-driven in hip-hop. One thing that we've gotten so far away from as men of color is saying that I love you to one another, to giving each other a hug. So in my book, I kind of create opportunities for us as young men and men of color to kind of break those barriers, to say it's okay to embrace your brother when you see him, even if it's for a long time and people are from a distance looking and saying, wow, he's holding him for a very long time, or he gave him a really tight hug. Why shouldn't we? Because we've gone so far away from that because it's so machismo, it's so, this is how it's gotta be because we're so hard. And you're trying to break those things down to understand you can still be hip hop and still be love.
Imani, let me ask you a slightly different question. When we think about the Black Arts Movement, it's very hard or difficult to detach that away from what was happening politically at that particular moment, right? And for many of us, you know, our introduction to the Black Arts Movement is solely in the context of a political movement, political poetry, stuff that could be uttered in public that you could not hear public, right? That it, if you think about the power of the rhetoric of Malcolm X in that particular moment, and then the Black Panther Party, and then that stuff was being represented aesthetically, right, in the work of Nikki Giovanni and Sonia Sanchez and late Gwendolyn Brooks with Hakeem Mahmoudi and those kind of folks. Is there a way for us to talk about the Black Arts Movement outside of the content? Was there an aesthetic form, for instance, around the Black Arts Movement that was just as important? And let me tell you where I get this from. You know, when Elizabeth Alexander was named as the inaugural poet, and the New York Times did a long interview with her shortly before the inauguration, and she made this point that very often when we think about Black poetry, it's always about what are the sociological realities of Black life that gets represented in the content of the poetry. But she says it's also a form, right? There's a Black form that takes place in terms of Black poetry. So what does that look like in terms of the Black Arts Movement?
The point that you ended with is part of why I even wrote Prophets of the Hood, was about making the argument that there is something going on aesthetically and artistically, and there was a point where people just reduced hip-hop to sociological conditions, and not just that, but reduced it to this is because they do this because there are no instruments in schools anymore, as opposed to recognizing what was happening that was creatively important and beautiful. But I think, you know, I'm also quite skeptical of the desire to turn away from the political content, just because everything has political content. Some of it is not explicit, but it all has political content. I mean, and I think for me, I mean, I think the significance of the Black Arts Movement for cultural production, subsequently for African American studies, is enormous, in part because what happens is that there's this kind of explicit confrontation with the encounter with urban space, right? Urban spaces are always cosmopolitan spaces. People are coming from other places to a metropole. They're navigating the economic landscape, they're navigating climate, they're navigating technology, they're navigating the dream of migrating, whether it is migrating north or migrating to the urban south or the Midwest, the dream and its deferral, right? And so that political moment, that artistic and creative moment, is really talking about, right, doing creative work at the intersection of all those forces. It opens up space for Black cultural studies, for the very, you know, this idea that there is a there, that there's an aesthetic foundation that can be taken to various kinds of expression that comes out of Black language and movement, you know, so that there's both this negotiation between the vernacular and the kind of explicitly artistic, you know, and I think it has ongoing resonance. For me, in particular, you know, I was born in 1972, so the albums in my home, the poetry albums, the music, you know, Donny Hathaway and Roberta Flack, the Afros, I mean, this kind of immersion into this celebration of Black embodiment. And so it's not just, we usually talk about in the academy the shift from civil rights to Black power, but not, we don't talk about Black consciousness. the transformative power of that sort of celebration of Black experience and embodiment and expressive culture. And so there is this aesthetic dimension, but I don't want to separate it from the politics, because I think it's bold and courageous because it claims the politics, where so often, particularly Western art, doesn't claim the politics, even though they're always there.
Right. I want to ask a broad question. I'm really thinking about it in terms of Anthony to really get at it first. But this question of sound, you know, if we think about the Black arts movement as an aesthetic movement, what was the sound of that movement? And in what ways has hip hop tapped into that as an ongoing legacy? Right, because there's a way, right? I remember Joan Morgan did this wonderful review of Ice Cube's America's Most Wanted when it first came out. And without even talking about the content of Ice Cube's music, which at least at that time was pretty explicitly political, you know, she said this sounds like warrior music. And she was talking about the production, right? That even when you listen to Dr. Dre, as problematic as his politics might have been, there was something insurgent about the sound of what was coming out of California in terms of the sound of gangster rap. So can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, you know, I always feel that we carry, I think every individual, every person, every unit carries a certain rhythm. We walk with a certain style, a certain rhythm. We run with a certain rhythm. We do it at our pace. And I think with the writing game, poetry, songwriting, even short story, any instance of creative writing where it's from your heart. So now we're getting to the blood flow. And I always think the sound is the sound of your heartbeat. And it's something like boom, boom, bop, boom, boom. And you can check your heartbeat sometimes and almost feel the rhythm coming out of your soul onto the paper, yeah, or onto your computer. You feel it, and I do. I experience that all the time, whether I'm writing a short statement, or I'm writing an essay, or I'm writing a poetry. And usually I write a lot, and I write. So I feel that boom, boom, bap, and it's always been hip-hop for me. It's always been, and I go way back. I go to Gil Scott-Heron, and I listen to him, and I listen to his chants, and I say the same thing. I said, those are warrior chants. Those are not, I'm begging you for something. It's, I'm going to take this, or I'm going to make you see who I am. You know, so it's more explosive, and there's no holding back. No holds bar. You can't tame it. You know what I mean? There's no taming of it. You got to let it out, and you got to let it out raw. So Cube, Ice Cube, all that America's Most Wanted, that was really raw rhythm and lyrically, he was at his peak, you know. So I think the rhythm in us, it extends to our writing game, to our dancing game, to our singing game, and it carries us through. It's sort of, it's like the wave that you ride on, you know. So you're either going high or you're going real low with it, but you're going.
But when you think about a Black arts figure like Amiri Baraka, he was a man of the people in the kind of way that literally you could be walking down the street in Newark and he'd be there and stop and have a conversation. So, you know, I'm not going to start with my conversation about when I met Amiri Baraka, because literally almost everybody in the room probably has had one of those moments. But I did have the opportunity to interview him extended period of time for about an hour and a half. And this was around the time of the Spike Lee Malcolm X film. And one thing that Baraka said to me that has stayed with me a long time was this idea that for all the money that was being spent for, in his opinion, what was a bastardized version of Malcolm X, that it would be better for folks to set up 20 seats in the basement of their houses and do community-based art, right? And that always stuck with me. And particularly as we've been watching all the losses that we have been watching over these last 18 months, the idea of independent Black institutions, right, as one of the lasting legacies of the Black arts movement, right, because they could not go to mainstream publishing houses to get this stuff published, right? There were no Black studies programs as we know it that could subsidize, you know, Black scholarship in that kind of way, right? You know, most folks don't know about the Institute of the Black World, Right, as we mentioned, Vincent Harding and folks of that nature. And so particularly for all of you on this panel who have done work both in terms of more traditional media, how important has it been to see yourself as independent artists with the capability to produce your work independently, right? Outside of major publishing houses, what power has the internet provided in terms of being able to do that kind of work? How important for us at this moment, as there's so much pressure for us to take our talent, if not to South Beach, to MSNBC or Fox News or ESPN or any place like that, how important for us is to continue to cultivate the idea of maintaining independent black institutions?
I still am currently in the music business. I've been in it since 1995. And I've been in a machine, so I know how the machine works. So I've taken all of everything that I've learned from the machine and brought it to an independent standpoint, understanding that we've lost so much humanistic, organic behavior because we are leaning on technology instead of going out and really shaking hands and kissing babies and attending programs like the Harlem Book Fair, because we're afraid or we're trying to hide behind the technology. But we'll find success when you start saying, hey, listen, I have a book out and these are the things that brought me to the point of writing it. I want to share these things with you. And I think as we get back to, instead of using social networking and really networking and rubbing elbows and, like I said, shaking hands, kissing babies, we're going to hide behind these things. But for me, it's, you got to touch the people, and for the people to embrace what it is that you're giving them from an independent standpoint, you have to go out there and really do the footwork. It's easy to send a Facebook message or a post or a tweet or an Instagram picture, but until they actually are able to touch you to understand, why did you write these things? Like, who are you? I want to know the fabric of what makes you who you are. Then we lose it in just out in, just to the world, because we're not doing what we need to do. So independently, it makes sense, because if you just throw it out there from a major standpoint, it gets lost in translation most of the time. And I think that's what's happening in the music business as well as publishing. And for events like this, it's important to be here, to be amongst the people, because so much dialogue going on, and it's just beautiful.
Sure.
I would say, like, you know, from the hip-hop standpoint, you know, it's a battle culture. So when you look at how I was brought into it at an early age, you know, I got into it, you see Graf on the trains, and you're like, I want to get down with that. And then, of course, you hear cats rhyme, the first rhyme, whether it's a mixtape or you're in the park, and you're like, what is that? I need to be a part of that energy. And it's live. But at the same point, why was it there? And you find out that there was no element supporting it. So it had to be, you know, I was used from the neighborhood of, like, that playground's always broken. You know, there was no basketball rim on the basketball court. So you go into it and you're like, there's no support. And then, you know, you go to some crazy neighborhoods and they got everything. And it could have been a Harlem, you know, downtown Brooklyn could have had everything. It doesn't, you know, New York services a lot of different neighborhoods, but hip hop draws you in a way where it was out of the necessity of, I want to be a part of something that is just has energy and fire. So it's a battle culture. And then, you know, you have to do it live. So you can't be hide. You really can't hide behind Instagram. You can promote it, and there's a lot of cats out there that are real fake. They say they do this, they say they do that. And as much as I get into corporate and I deal with the TV and film companies over my years, it always comes back to, if you're going to have teeth in the game, you have to help finance it. It never gets around it, because they're just going to take it away from you. So you know you're swimming with sharks, but coming back to the culture of doing it live. So if I have to do, you know, I always feel more blessed when I'm painting something live or doing a gallery, people come in and see the work, and they're like, yeah, it looked fly on Instagram, but seeing it in real life, that's different. And, you know, I always encourage cats to, like, at our art shows, to battle cyphers or breakdance, whatever, because it's live. So there again, going back to reinforce that, it's like you have to experience it as a family or as a unit. And that's kind of, and then that uplifts you to go and do something. And I think, and it's a struggle, it ain't easy. Like, you know, like some days I'll have 100 people I got to pay on my payroll, and some days I got 3. It fluctuates on the project. And then there's times where you got no more money and you're like, okay, why am I keep doing this? It's because of the energy of it. and you it picks you back up.
Because whatever we want to say about the revolution still has to be financed, right? It's like nothing's going down for free. One of the folks who has carried on the legacy of the Black Arts Movement, particularly in hip-hop, a figure like Chuck D. And Chuck has this great line about, you know, the need to rock the bourgeois and the boulevard, right? And we know what rocking the boulevard looks like, right? Let's talk a moment about rocking the bourgeois. And particularly Imani and Melissa in this context, you know, one of the places where the Black Arts Movement has continued to be vital, though under assault, is in academia, right? And particularly in terms of Black Studies departments. I know, Melissa, you had the opportunity to work with Mark Nason at Fordham University. And for those of you who don't know Mark, part of it is that he's been this amazing historian of both labor history, but the history of the Bronx. But for those folks who don't know Mark, the historian, they know him as the white guy that was on Dave Chappelle's skit, you know, I know what black people think, who, if you remember, was described as a black studies professor, right? So what does it look like to be able to continue to do the work around the Black Arts Movement in the academy, and particularly around this idea, you know, all those folks who are doing the groundwork, the organic work, you know, in the late 50s and early 60s in what blossoms in terms of the Black Arts Movement, you know, their idea was never that this stuff would go into places like Duke or in Princeton for us to teach classes and students, you know, who comes from families that are worth $250,000 and things like that. You know, how do we both do the work that is educationally still true to what the vision was of the Black Arts Movement in terms of an educational project, but also do that in spaces that both devalue doing that kind of work and devalue the very narratives that are represented in terms of the Black Arts Movement?
Well, I actually kind of want to combine that, mm-hmm. your previous question with this question, in that one of the important legacies, I think, about the Black Arts Movement is that it started creating communities of artists. Yeah. And so this is where you really got kind of like the first people really doing workshops and having, you know, younger black artists be mentored by older black artists and create that kind of community, which is incredibly important because, you know, writing can seem like is something that you only do by yourself, but writing is really a collaborative act. You need editors, you need feedback, and that's just a part of the process. Nobody puts out a book, anything, that is solely their work. And I think, you know, that is something that can be seen now in African American Studies department, at least in my department. Now I'm at Yale doing a PhD. And so a lot of the people, like Elizabeth Alexander and who and other professors who were very influenced by the Black Arts Movement, that sense of creating community, especially when it was, there weren't necessarily spaces, they're hard fought. And so, you know, that's also created, at least for us in that department, a culture where we really value the history of our department. We really value the struggles that have gone before us, and we also have a very keen eye towards, wait, you're taking away what? No, that's not going to happen. That's not going to fly. You know, so we're very also protective of our department, that kind of community building. And you also see that in other things. Cave Canem is another great, yeah, I think, right. You know, institution that's come out similarly from that practice of community building and artists.
Dark Room Collective.
Exactly.
And you're tuned to The Cutting Edge on a Forum, The New Urban Aesthetics, The Black Arts Movement Revised, which was sponsored by the Harlem Book Fair at the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture.
the Erez Crossing, which is where you enter Gaza from. So apparently, when you go into Gaza, you have to walk until you get to the first town there. And apparently that walk is very dangerous.
KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of Indigenous Rights, Palestine, and Academic Freedom. Thursday, April 9th at 6:30 p.m. at Portland State University's Smith Center, room 338. Guest speaker will be Stephen Saleta, former Virginia Tech professor. That's Indigenous Rights, Palestine, and Academic Freedom, sponsored by Students United